Okay, this is a little lunchtime entertainment for you. This is some work that I did with my former postdoc, Fabio Maltoni. Now, there's another Maltoni in the neutrino community who you probably all know. This is not, that is M. That's one of Valencia. Okay, that's M. Maltoni. This is Fabio Maltoni. Fabio is now left, and he's in Rome. And my student, my ex-student, that is, Mike Nitschikorek, who is now at MIT. This is work. This was part of Mike's dissertation. And all I'm going to do is put an upper bound on the scale of Majorana neutrino mass generation, which is my title. And this work is part of a larger piece of work that we did on fermion masses in general, which is in, here's the references. Okay, you can get it off the web if you're interested. So the point of this talk is I'm going to make as few assumptions as possible. It's going to be very minimalistic, you know, no specific model. I'm going to be as model independent as I possibly can be. That's sort of the philosophy. So let me start with my assumptions. First of all, just standard model fields. And to be exact, I will use a lepton doublet. And a right-handed lepton field, but there won't be any right-handed neutrinos. So no sterile neutrinos, at least not at low energies. So my other assumption is that the Lagrangian is out of the standard model. And of course, if that's true, then neutrino masses are exactly zero. But of course, we know that's not true anymore. What's the minimal thing we can do to accommodate non-zero neutrino masses given these assumptions? Well, one thing we can do, which is very minimal, is to just add more terms to the Lagrangian. And of course, this is the old effective field theory point of view, that the standard model contains terms of dimension 4 in terms of the fields. But there's no reason based on gauge symmetry or any other argument why we should restrict ourselves simply to those terms. Of course, these are the renormalizable terms, but we no longer regard renormalizability as a fundamental requirement of a useful field theory. So we then realize we can extend, this is not a useful eraser, our theory to include dimensions of interactions of higher dimensionality. The first one would be of dimension 5. And just by dimensional analysis, it must have a coefficient which has dimensions of an inverse mass. And I'll even put a dimensionless coefficient C here in front of that. OK, plus dimension 6, et cetera. Another coefficient here, C prime. And of course, at ordinary, we think of capital M here as being a very large mass scale. And at ordinary energies, these interactions are suppressed because they're, for example, this interaction here, which is going to be the leading one at low energies, is effectively going to have a strength of the dimensionless coefficient times 1 over m times a relevant energy scale. And at ordinary energies, if this mass scale is much greater than 1 TeV, say, that's a small expansion parameter. Okay, now the remarkable thing, of course, is that in the standard model, meaning that with just the standard model field content, there's one and only one dimension 5 interaction you can write down, and that has the form in terms of fields L phi, L phi, where phi is the Higgs doublet field and L is the lepton doublet field. I mean, that's pretty impressive, right, that there's only one allowed term. Whereas when you go to dimension 6, I mean, there's a huge number of terms, I don't know, order 100. Terms you can write down. If you don't impose any, you know, baryon number conservation or lepton number conservation or anything like that, many, many terms you can write down.
I know that there are many, many terms, but I'm surprised of 100. I would guess like 20 or something. Why 100?
Yeah, in fact, I have not done the counting myself. I think that you get up to that number when you start including mixing between different generations. So in other words, the fact that there's three generations, you know, if you start counting that, you quickly get up to a very large number.
That way, they mentioned five across as well.
Yeah, okay, that's fair, actually.
Because I did write down all those terms at one time.
Mm-hmm.
I no longer care about references because I have a good job already. But I would like to help out my collaborator. I wrote a paper with Art Weldon, who didn't really get a good job. I think Paul Lampen knows him also. He was a fan. And so he should be mentioned. I think most people reference Weinberg, but Weldon and I also mentioned Weinberg.
Right.
Where is Weldon?
In West Virginia.
West Virginia. He really got out of his job. And we also wrote down, I think we mentioned this one. I just don't remember. So you could probably.
Yeah, in fact, okay, I'm not sure about the counting. There's many more here than here, but the exact numbers. In fact, almost everything I'm going to tell you today is so well known that I won't put down any references because it's become classic part of the literature. So yes, you're right. In fact, Weinberg at least is credited with writing this operator down first. There are, I know your paper with Weldon. There's other, Buchmüller and Wheeler also wrote an important paper here. So this is really quite, it's so well known that it's known to everyone. So I'm not going to try to keep up with references. It's become part of the lore, right, that we all know. Now, so M here is, we think of as a scale of new physics, right? M is going to be where the physics resides that's responsible for neutrino mass generation. In the limit that m goes to infinity, the neutrino masses are certainly going to go back to zero, because in the limit m goes to infinity, all these operators are infinitely suppressed. You're back to the standard model, and in the standard model, the neutrino masses are zero. So m is going to have a physical interpretation of the scale of Majorana neutrino mass generation. And of course, I say Majorana neutrino because I'm assuming that at low energies, at least, there is no gauge singlet fermion that could act as a right-handed neutrino. And so the mass is necessarily Majorana, not Dirac. What I'd like to do is put an upper bound on what M could be. And I'm going to do that by considering the fact that by introducing this dimension 5 interaction here, I have now a new expansion parameter in the theory. This is it, in fact. This is the expansion parameter. In order for this to be a useful, effective theory, this expansion parameter has to be less than or equal to order 1. And I'm now going to try to make this order 1 a little bit more precise, sort of getting the factors of pi correct, by using unitarity argument. Okay, so first of all, as you know, the presence of this dimension 5 interaction here does give a neutrino mass. And in fact, just looking at the coefficient here and remembering that phi has a vacuum expectation value of v, or v over root 2 actually, the neutrino mass comes out to be c over m times v squared. So that's an equation we'll use. And as I said, as m goes to infinity, the neutrino mass goes to 0 because you just return back to the standard model. This dimension 5 interaction here also gives new interactions. For example, neutrino goes to Higgs. It's a contact interaction. And the strength of that interaction is C times 1 over M, just the coefficient of that operator. Now, when you evaluate the amplitude for this, and in fact, it's the zeroth partial wave that turns out to give the strongest bound, the zeroth partial wave amplitude comes out to be proportional to C times 1 over M times E. And using the fact that C over M is proportional to M nu over V squared, this is. So this interaction is growing with energy. Okay, but this isn't the only process that has that characteristic. In fact, if we look at neutrino, neutrino goes to pretty much any pair of longitudinal vector bosons, we find the same behavior. So, for example, neutrino, neutrino goes to longitudinal Z boson. Remember, longitudinal just means helicity zero. This amplitude also is proportional to the neutrino mass times the energy divided by V squared. Now, in fact, I should be a little bit careful here because there are several Feynman diagrams. Let me, in fact, be a little bit more careful. Now, why longitudinal Zs? Well, remember, longitudinal Zs sort of came from the Goldstone bosons, from the Higgs field. The Higgs field has Goldstone bosons in them that get eaten by the Ws and Zs. So these guys are sort of in the same class, if you like, as Higgs fields. And so that's why, you know, this, if this grows with energy, so is this going to also. That, what I just gave you is sort of a argument called the Goldstone boson equivalence theorem, that in a sense, at high energies, you can think of longitudinal Zs and Ws as being the Goldstone bosons before they were eaten. So all amplitudes involving external longitudinal Zs and Ws and Higgs fields are going to grow with energy. Notice, by the way, I have included a Higgs exchange diagram here, because after all, the Higgs does couple to neutrinos, just like it has from this interaction, and it has two Higgs coupling to neutrinos. It also, this gives rise to one Higgs coupling to neutrinos. But despite the fact that you have the Higgs exchange there, this amplitude still grows with energy. It goes like m nu e over v squared. Okay, similarly, if you were to look at W production, of course, these are charged leptons in here. Also here, you have a cross diagram now because the neutrinos are Majorana, so the lepton number, if you like, could be moving up here or down here. And you also have a Z exchange and a Higgs exchange. Amusingly, though, what you find is that this amplitude does not grow with energy. The terms that grow with energy cancel and leave behind terms that actually fall off with energy.
So this is the famous story about how Weinberg kicked his student out of the community.
I don't know this story.
After Weinberg wrote the paper, he asked his student to come in his process, and the student could get some sign error. The first term that he just crossed out.
Oh.
And so this is why Weinberg didn't push it for several years. So he said publicly, I made sure that guy did not get a job. This is something I've heard.
So we don't know the name of this person then. I see. That's interesting. Okay, and you know, at first we were a little puzzled because if you go through this, you know, I mean, you can do all sorts of processes, right? You can do neutrino charged lepton scattering. Let's say it goes to ZW plus so you have a neutrino in here, and here you have a charged lepton. And there's also W. This one also grows with energy. In fact, this one goes like m nu times e over v squared times the MNS matrix element. So this is the ith neutrino. That's the elf lepton. This one does involve the MNS matrix. Notice the other ones don't. And that's because if you take the ith neutrino here and the jth neutrino here, this thing ends up being proportional to delta ij. Same here. Because, I mean, just by unitarity of the MNS matrix, you sum over, let's say, I don't know where I put my i's and j's. Oh, here, I meant to put it here. When you, I mean, here you get uli, and here you get ulj star. And when you sum over leptons, remember, we're thinking of energies much larger than the lepton masses. When you sum over leptons, you're just getting uu dagger, and that's one. So that goes away. So it doesn't matter what the mixing angles are and so on for our argument.
Well, I mean, right-handed agreement, the so-called MNS matrix is not unitary. It's known not to be unitary.
Well, remember, my assumptions are that there are no light right-handed neutrinos.
Yeah, but then there is this mystery, because you have the dimension 5 operator, but then you want somehow to interpret it as a Meyer-Adams term.
Well, I don't want to do that. I will do that in a second, but at this point, I'm not doing that. Right? So there is no right-handed neutrino in this argument at all. That's one possible interpretation, but I will not. Nothing I say here will depend on that.
But that's interesting. So the amplitude there is just proportional to u, you say.
Yeah.
One power u.
Yeah. Yes. Hmm. Yeah. From here. And just for completeness, the last process you can also consider is lepton-lepton scattering with neutrino exchange, giving W minus W minus. This is, you know, this is the same diagram that's involved in neutrinoless double beta decay. Oops. Plus cost. And this one is also grows with energy. And it involves the sum over neutrino masses of the square of the square of the MNS matrix. And again, that's familiar from neutrinoless double beta decay, right? No, that's right. Not absolute square, just square.
Yeah, because it's the same structure as double beta decay.
Yeah. This is neutrinoless double beta decay just turned around.
Oh, okay. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I think I got them all right. Okay, so now you apply the unitarity condition. Which is really, I mean, all unitarity is a condition that the strength of the interaction not be too strong. Remember, I just erased it. The effective strength of the interaction here is C E over M. But of course, C over M is M nu over V squared. So that's E M nu over V squared. And that's what all those diagrams are proportional to, right? Or all those amplitudes are proportional to, E M nu over V squared. So you're just asking that those things not be too strong, that you're in the regime where the expansion parameter is not too big. And the condition is that these, at least the condition on an inelastic scattering process, is that the modulus of the amplitude shouldn't exceed a half. Okay, so this is what unitarity gives you. And it turns out that, you know, you look at all these processes, you're allowed to take linear combinations of initial and final states. So you don't have to really think necessarily of a totally physical process. It turns out that the strongest bound comes from considering the following rather strange process. But here it is. It's a zeroth partial wave of this state. So this is a two positive helicity Majorana neutrinos. Minus two negative helicity Majorana neutrinos going into a final state, which is linear combination of two longitudinal z's and two Higgs's. And again, I'm thinking about doing this at energies much greater than the weak scale. So for all intents and purposes, the Higgs mass is negligible, the Z masses are negligible. I'm taking them to be essentially massless particles. You know, why it's this particular combination, I actually don't know. But that's just from calculation. It turns out this amplitude is equal to minus m nu times e all over 8 pi v squared. And of course, the 8 pi here came from taking the zeroth partial wave. And now you can see, demanding that this thing be less than a half tells you that the expansion is going to break down at energies of 4 pi v squared over m nu. So I will call that energy the critical energy. That's the energy at which the expansion breaks down. I will call that lambda sub Majorana. And if you like, I mean, any of you would have guessed that the upper bound on the scale of Majorana neutrino mass generation is going to be proportional to v squared over m nu. All I've done is formalized it a little bit and derived this factor of 4 pi.
Okay, what's the upper bound on the surface of expansion?
That's right. That's the upper. That is the highest energy at which I can still consider this effective field theory, which has this expansion parameter, as being valid. I mean, once I get to energies greater than that, that effective field theory no longer makes sense.
So if neutrino mass is generated at a higher energy, you need some other way to calculate
it. No, I'm saying the neutrino mass can't be generated at a higher energy scale. This is the upper bound on the scale of neutrino mass generation.
Why can't we generate?
Well, there would basically be no effective field theory you can write down that would have, that could generate such a light neutrino mass.
No,
but
then just because it's non-perturbative. You can't pull out TCD because it's non-perturbative.
No, it's not non-perturbative. It's perturbative versus effective. I mean, if you had a microscopic theory, of course it makes sense. It would sense like, because it's effective.
I guess that's simply the validity of the effective description.
Exactly.
That's beyond that, you need the full description with the right-handed exchanges.
Right. Is this, which neutrino mass, I mean, taking degenerate masses?
No, actually, I'm going to consider one neutrino at a time. I could later consider the case of a quasi-degenerate, but I'm sort of imagining there's a hierarchy here. So, in fact, nothing I've said is dependent on any of that. But
let me try to understand. So, if neutrino mass is generated with higher energy, you cannot use effective field theory. You have to do lattice, or you have to do something else.
No, I mean,
no. It's interesting that it's just the energy scale at which this particular neutrino mass and force describe the theory. That's what Carl said.
In fact, I think it's most analogous to the old Fermi theory of the weak interaction, right? Because in the old Fermi theory of the weak interaction, you had an effective interaction, which wasn't dimension 5, it was in fact dimension 6, right? It was a 4 fermion interaction. And I believe it was Yang and Li who first used this unitarity argument to say that this effective interaction, this 4 fermion interaction, is only a good description of physics up to a scale of around 600 GeV.
I doubt that it's Yang and Li. I mean, it must go back to people like Fermi and Heisenberg.
Ah.
It must be much older.
Okay. Well, like I said, Tony will correct me. And I was right. But, I don't know. But it's very analogous to that, I think, right? Instead of hearing have a 4 fermion interaction, you have a 2 fermion 2 scalar, but it's the same philosophy. That once you get up, I mean, in this case, the expansion parameter is G Fermi times energy squared. And if you use the unitarity analysis, you find that at 600 GeV, the Fermi theory ceases to be a useful description of the physics. I'm making the same argument here. Okay, so let me since right-handed neutrinos have been mentioned, let's imagine that M here is the mass of a right-handed neutrino. By that I mean a gauge singlet fermion. What happens? Well, as you know, what happens is once you get to the scale M, you'll have to change your effective theory, right? You'll have to now include this field. And what you'll find is that there are now new contributions to the Feynman diagrams. For example, here we had neutrino exchange, but let me see. Let me not call this new right. I don't like that. So let's call it capital N. Okay, so that's a sterile neutrino. Now you'll have to include this guy in the Feynman diagrams. It'll go in there and there. And you won't be surprised to hear that those diagrams exactly cancel the terms that grow with energy, and you no longer have unitarity violation. So you've gone from an effective theory to a renormalizable theory, right? One that the renormalizable theory doesn't have any amplitudes that grow with energy. Similarly, now you can understand, by the way, why this never grew with energy, right? Because when I introduce the sterile neutrino into the theory, I don't get any new Feynman diagrams, right? There's charged lepton here, here, Z exchange, Higgs exchange. There's no new diagram generated. So this couldn't have grown with energy, because when I made it the theory go from effective to renormalizable, I didn't get any new Feynman diagrams. The Weinberg student didn't know that argument, I suspect. By the way, I was also a student of Weinberg's,
Really?
He didn't try not to get me a job or to get me a job.
No,
so I did better than the other would.
Mine was very, very tough on the student, and I narrowly escaped because I was destined to be a student. But Steve Adler told me I shouldn't work for him because mine was too tough. There are four diagrams. I thought about this. Even a very good student with 80%, suppose I have 80% chance of getting a sine of each diagram. Then it's 1 minus 0.8 to the 4th power that I would not get the right answer. It's 60%, 1 minus 0.8 to the 4th power. Yeah. 60% of chance I would have my career crushed.
What happened to the student?
Apparently he was and got a job.
Yeah, but I mean, he's presumably got a job doing something else.
Like yeah, I don't know.
Driving the taxi cab or...
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he's in this room. I mean, it would be interesting to find out.
Yeah. Well, Scott apparently survived. You said Weinberg didn't help you get it.
Nor did he stand in my way.
No, he didn't say anything.
He just ignored me.
Well, that's what Polyakov did to his one of his students, Ferrari, when I decided to hire him. I mean, he just wouldn't write the letter.
Okay, so, I mean, you can see now, when I introduce this sterile neutrino in here, of course, you're going to get new Feynman diagrams, and lo and behold, everything you think is true is true. Okay, let me also just mention, you know, let's face it, we're all very attracted to this theory with a sterile neutrino, right? This is the seesaw mechanism. It's not the only possibility, of course. Let me just mention, without really going into it, another possibility would be to have a Higgs triplet, okay? Higgs triplet field phi. That also gives you a renormalizable theory that generates Majorana neutrino masses. This guy contains a lot of new Higgs fields. It contains another. Besides the standard model like Higgs, it contains another neutral Higgs, a negatively charged Higgs, a singly charged Higgs, I should say, and a doubly charged Higgs. And you won't be surprised to hear that when you introduce the additional Feynman diagrams that are generated by these guys, again, all the terms that grow with energy cancel. So, for example, here you would have another Higgs exchanged. Let's see, same here. Here you'd get a new diagram where, in addition to W exchange, you'd also have charged Higgs exchange. And here you'd generate a new diagram with the doubly charged Higgs. And again, since this is a renormalizable theory, once you put in all the diagrams, all the terms of growth energy cancel. And there's no right-handed neutrino field anywhere. So this is an alternative to the usual seesaw mechanism. I mean, this is also a seesaw in a sense.
So how does that work? It's also part of the seesaw mechanism.
I'm sorry?
It is also part of the full seesaw mechanism, the triplet.
It need not be, right?
No, but for example, left right symmetric or SO10 models, it is. So in fact, people often forget this contribution, and it's there. And it's actually important.
Right. In fact, I think Mohapatra referred to this in his talk last week, right, as what he called type 1 and type 2.
Well, actually, there are two seesaw contributions, the Higgs-induced and the Neurite-induced.
Right.
And induced.
Right. I'm not sure I would call this one a seesaw, but they do. You're right, they both are present.
No, it is a seesaw because when you actually minimize the potential, you see that there is a back seesaw relation that enforces that the back of the triplet is inversely proportional to the square of the right triplet. So it's very much the same. It doesn't break up. What it breaks up is the flavor structure. All the games that people play with textures and things like that are completely broken if this term is present.
Now, how does this work for the nu to ww? There wasn't a growing term to begin with, but now you say there's a new diagram. Is that introduced?
Oh, that's a good point, Paul. You're right. That's a good point. I shot myself in the foot by saying that, right?
Yep.
Now let's see, how does that work? Do I remember that off the top of my head?
Well, maybe it cancels against the Z exchange, something in the Z diagram.
It's one new Higgs. I remember this. Just no Higgs's. I don't see it. So do you see his question? I mean, here I said in this theory with the triplet Higgs, I don't have the sterile neutrino anymore. This grew with energy, but the addition of this the additional Higgs exchange here cancels the terms with growth energy. Of course, this one didn't grow with energy, and you would have thought the additional Higgs here would now bring in terms that grow with energy. And that doesn't happen, but it's not obvious to me.
I think it's higher than that. Well, where does the single
H?
Little h come from when you don't have a higher dimensional? So the little h?
I'm sorry, Aida?
The big H comes from the
other one.
The theory is not wrong. You have to write everything that is compatible with the symmetries we're having.
It's only the T diagram. The
little H is actually
not the T channel.
I guess he's putting a
bed.
That needs the.
No, because the longitudinal W is bringing factors of energy in the numerator.
Then you see it doesn't exist, then the little H that doesn't exist.
So that's
a good question.
You understand the question?
Yes, I do understand the question. I don't know the answer though. That's the problem. Okay, I'm stumped at this point. I don't know. I mean, I know it works, but I don't remember why exactly. Okay, so don't tell Weinberg.
Well, if you write down all possible terms, are you sure you have written down all possible diagrams? Once you introduce little h, it couples to.
Where does the little h come from?
Oh, sorry. There is, of course, the ordinary Higgs doublet is still present in this theory.
Yeah, then you have a couple of phi.
Yeah, but phi h, I guess
it's
not working hard parity. How do you couple the little h?
But it's not coupled to the neutrinos now.
That's right.
The little h is not any longer coupled to the neutrinos.
Left on little h coupling does not exist now.
Yeah. So you have only the triplet.
You have really only the triplet.
Is that it?
Triplet does have a coupling, obviously.
Yeah. So actually, there, what it's too much is the small little h, which shouldn't be there.
The little h is not there, it's replaced.
Okay, well, you're reminding me that, of course, this is essentially the Gelmini-Roncadelli model, so maybe Graciela and I can.
You know, in that vest doesn't work.
Well, the little triplet was.
It doesn't work in that.
The little triplet was introduced before Graciela.
Much before.
Okay.
So this was at least.
Okay, I'll have to think about it. I just don't remember how that works. Let me now sort of get to the physics, because this has all been, or at least to some numbers. So we have some, we don't have any absolute measurement of neutrino masses, of course, but we have measurements of mass square differences. And so, delta M atmospheric, I'll take to be 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3 EV. And so this, of course, this alone tells you that at least one neutrino must have a mass greater than the square root of that, which comes out to be 0.05 EV. So that's a lower bound of the neutrino mass, which means an upper bound on this. But this itself is an upper bound. So you're putting an upper bound on an upper bound, which is still an upper bound, thank goodness. If you put an upper bound on a lower bound, you're not doing anything. Okay? So putting in the 4 pi's and so on, this tells you that the scale for the generation of this neutrino mass is less than or equal to 1.5 times 10 to the 16th GeV. Okay, similarly, you can do the same thing with the solar. Yes?
The obvious intermediate step. How did you bound the bed?
Oh, V here?
Yeah.
So that's the usual 246 GeV.
Okay.
Yeah. And this leads to, let's see. So, no, I got that wrong. 9 times 10 to the 16th. There we go. So these are the numbers. They're both of order 10 to the 16th GeV, 10 to the 17th GeV. Remember, what this says is the scale of Majorana neutrino mass generation is less than these numbers. It could be much less than these numbers, right? These are just upper bounds. So what can we say about these numbers? Well, one obvious thing is that they are less than the Planck scale, right? If we take the Planck scale to be the usual h bar c over g to 1/2, that's 10 to the 19th GeV. So these are definitely can't be as large as the Planck scale. Now, does that mean that these cannot be associated with quantum gravity? No, I would say it doesn't. Because the Planck scale, if you like, is the upper bound on the scale of quantum gravity. In other words, quantum gravity, the short distance theory of quantum gravity must become relevant or manifest at least by this scale, but it could be less. So for example, in string theory, you have something called the string scale, and at least in perturbative string theory, the string scale is about 3 times 10 to the 17th GeV. Okay, so you start to see string physics at a scale less than the Planck scale. And that's just an example. I mean, there's no law of nature saying that quantum gravity must set in at 10 to the 19th GeV. It could set in earlier than that. So you can't really say that these scales are not associated with quantum gravity. All you can say is they are not the Planck scale. It's interesting, though, that they don't even make it to the string scale. So, you know, perhaps that's arguing that these cannot be string scale physics. But then, of course, that is just, you know, good old-fashioned perturbative string theory. And we now know if you take strongly coupled string models into account, you can move the string scale below that. People these days even take the string scale down to 1 TeV. So you can't necessarily make such a strong statement.
Scott, it sort of looks like, well, 9 times 10 to the 16, 3 times 10 to the 17, they're close. But
yeah.
Isn't that a cheat? Because you know that one of the masses has to be 0.05 dB or bigger. So that's the only relevant amount, isn't it?
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah, but there's something else. In your model, you're assuming that most of this neutrino mass comes from this five-dimensional term. If there is any other origin which is not related to that, then you don't have any amount.
So you have in mind, for example, a model in which at low energy, you don't have the dimension 5 term?
Farther, if you would have a Dirac mass, which is very small and gives you that, then the Majorana would be relevant.
Yeah, but of course that violates my assumptions, right? Because I'm assuming that there is...
Then those depend only on... Your assumption is that this mass comes mostly from this dimension 5 operator and nothing else. This is your assumption. If there would be another origin, then you don't have that.
Within my stated assumptions, which was standard model fields only,
that's true.
Then at low energies, the neutrino mass must come from the dimension 5 operator.
There's no other way.
Yeah.
No. I think Garcial is saying that, for example, you can have a theory. You're assuming a lot because you're assuming one mass scale. Graziella, for example, can imagine a dimension 6 term of some other mass scale m prime.
I was being simplistic.
And the value of m prime and m could be such that the dimension 6 term contributes just as much as the dimension 5 term, even though it's m prime squared.
Yeah, you have a higher dimension but characterized by a much lower scale. So somehow it is a, I mean, you might have a symmetry that forbids the dimension 5 and allow only dimension 6, mm-hmm. In which case this would be.
Kind of hard to arrange, right?
Well, that symmetry would be hard because you just have lepton plus lepton x.
Assume that you have the neutrino right, but you don't like it.
No, you cannot put. In his assumption, you cannot.
No, in his assumption, that does not.
So that's not valid.
Well, in his assumption, then the only origin is one.
No, or further dimension, higher dimension terms.
You're right,
so if you were, for some reason, start at the sixth level, then I do not realize it in practice. But
I'm not sure. Maybe then the scale will be much larger.
Right, but these are all upper bounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think if it was dimension 6, you'd be, for a given neutrino mass, you'd be led to even lower scale. So this is still an upper bound in that sense.
This is still an upper bound, but assume that you have a neutrino right, nobody forbids you, and it is a...
I guess so.
You have your neutrino right, and you have a very small Yukawa coupling, Dirac. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes that,
but then
you wouldn't know exactly which contribution. This would be a mixing.
Or if some new physics gets diagrams to this account, for some intermediate scale, then your assumption is that it's just a standard problem.
So we
are appreciating now the power of your assumptions.
But I mean, you know, what else can you do, right? I mean, all of that is, what I'm saying is that there must be new physics. In the case, atmospheric neutrinos are pointing us to the fact that there must be new physics before that scale. Solar neutrinos are telling us there must be new physics before that scale.
No, look, take my objection, which of course many people don't like. The mass of the electron, it has a coupling which is 10 to the minus 6. It's just mere Yukawa-Ugly coupling.
Right.
So take one which is 10 to the minus 10, equally ugly and so on, and just put a coupling with your usual doublet, which we know is there, or we suspect the strongest.
You're talking about a right-handed neutrino.
And then you have a Dirac. Nobody knows this. These neutrinos are mostly Dirac. Then you will have also maybe a contribution from there, which can be as small as you like, because it wouldn't be generating the masses. And therefore, lambda Majorana may be so high as whatever you want.
Right, but
you have a hybrid situation where Dirac coexist with dimension 5.
No,
but look,
nobody knows if neutrinos are not Dirac particles.
I'm arguing that what you're talking about is subsumed by this scenario, because you're talking about introducing another field into the low energy theory. Okay, so that I would say that's new physics. If you're saying there's a right-handed neutrino in your low energy theory, I would say that's new physics, and that new physics did come in below this scale, these scales. So that's just an example of new physics.
I call it.
Yes, the new right field is new physics. Yeah. So remember, I'm starting, I explicitly said.
It's lower than this. It's just a standard model physics. It's lower. It's kind of a genius.
No, no, I don't think that a right-handed neutrino is standard model physics. The standard model only contains, doesn't contain a right-handed neutrino field. So by putting that in, you've gone beyond the standard model.
In my proposal that I say, which is very simple, but this is just what we handle the GV, because this is what the coupling is.
But you need something to protect that scale, right?
But it could be as heavy as we want. This lambda Majorana could be 10 to the 19 GV, could be anything. Doesn't prevent you from putting them there.
No, if there is a right-handed neutrino, then you should throw these away. I mean, you've got your new physics that came in below these scales, and I was right. I told you there'd be no. I mean, that's it. That's the argument. Right? I'm just saying there's new physics below these scales.
But they could be as high as you want.
You could have a situation, for example, take the three neutrinos and add one right-handed neutrino at some seesaw scale, whatever you want. So you could have then. The dimension 5, in fact, what you get in that case is only one linear combination, gets a seesaw suppressed mass, and the other two remain massless. So you can lift the degeneracy of the massless subspace by a higher dimension operator contribution. So you have somehow a coexistence between a seesaw contribution and a non-normalizable contribution. I just wonder how your argument would apply to that case, which is perfectly viable, I think.
Right.
In fact, it gives a nice starting point. So you can imagine the two low-lying neutrinos, and when you split them, you can generate solar oscillations, and the other one is associated to the atmosphere. I mean, the mass of the other one is associated to the atmospheric scale.
Yeah.
It's very minimalistic. Mm-hmm. You have a seesaw for the atmospheric scale, and you have a higher dimension operator for the solar scale.
Right, and then you could go through and make the same argument. You just have to include, you'll have additional Feynman diagrams here. Of course, they will not completely cancel the terms that grow with energy, right? Because you're not putting in three sterile neutrinos, you're only putting in one.
Yeah.
So you can go through and make the same argument. And you'll be led to some new scales.
Three mu's, but only one n.
Right, right. So you won't get a complete cancellation of the terms that grow with energy. You may get a partial cancellation of them, but you won't get a complete cancellation.
But if you include everything, the theory is consistent. If you include all the fields, it should be completely consistent.
Well, no, but I mean, if you only have one sterile neutrino in your theory, I mean, you needed three sterile neutrinos in order to get a complete cancellation, right? In order to have a completely renormalizable theory, you'd need three sterile neutrinos.
No, you don't need to.
I think it's totally consistent.
No, you don't
need to.
Okay.
May I make a comment?
Yes.
I mean, this kind of argument, you know, as Cosenko was saying, it's very powerful because you made it extremely restrictive, but it's much too restrictive and simplistic. For example, I have a concrete example. Suppose I look at the model that I wrote down many years ago. And in this model, you remember, I introduced one single scalar field, which couples to fermions and which couples to Higgs. So there's the coupling, you know, of the thing to fermions, to Higgs, and the mass of this guy, and the coupling to Higgs, because it's through scalar field, is dimensional mass as well. So when you say 1 over m, that m in my specific model is not 1 m, but it's some complicated combination of all these masses and so on.
Weak scale.
Right. So it's not the mass of the scalar particle in my model. So the new physics may appear at something completely different from this m.
Anywhere below.
Exactly.
So at the weak scale, you have the Z model, Babu model, lots of variations. Even seesaw type models, which I think Paul mentioned yesterday, it's also weak scale.
But how does that contradict anything I've said?
No, it does not contradict.
Oh, okay.
It does not contradict.
Okay, fine.
I guess the only contradiction could be if you just add the new right and write down a small Lyapunov coupling, with no explanation or nothing, just the ugly Lyapunov coupling, then there is no need to have a Majorana at all. So calling the lambda Majorana is kind of irrelevant.
Okay,
if you just put it divided, you have only the argument.
But I mean, I'm just going to say this one more time. A new right field is new physics.
Okay.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's all I had to say. So thank you very much for your attention. It's been a lot of fun.